Russians say enough is enough today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Angry protests in Russia in the wake of a deadly shopping mall fire.
There's a sense here that corruption primarily is at play, that safety inspectors were simply paid off to look the other way.
And we ask a former Moscow firefighter if he was surprised by the tragedy.
I was surprised as a person and not surprised as a professional.
Plus, Lisbeth Mateo is an attorney in California who followed an unusual path to law school.
My first day of orientation was very interesting. Everyone knew I was the girl who got detained at the border and 17 days in detention.
Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thank you for being with us today. Here in the U.S., the expulsion of 60 Russian diplomats has been pretty dramatic. It's dramatic for Russians as well, but news of the expulsions has been crowded out by another shocking story from the Siberian city of Kemerovo. People in Kemerovo are taking to the streets and demanding answers after a massive fire swept through a shopping mall over the weekend. Dozens of people are reported dead, many of them children. And residents of Kemerovo are pointing the finger at the Russian government. They're saying the response to the tragedy has been slow, inadequate, even dishonest. Some have gone so far as to call on Russian President Putin to resign over the official response to the crisis. For more on this, we have reporter Charles Maines on the line with us from Moscow. Hey, Charles.
Hi, Marco. Good to be with you.
So as we just heard, there's lots of anger from locals in Kemerovo, and it's directed at their local officials, at federal officials in Russia. We heard them accusing officials of lying to them, demanding answers. What do they think the government is lying about?
Well, fundamentally, they think that they're lying about the number of dead, that these accusations that authorities have just been unforthcoming about the numbers of victims, questions, of course, over the competency of the rescue operation, people saying that rescue workers insisted that areas had been evacuated from this mall in Kemerovo when, in fact, they hadn't been. And also anger just over this, the way state media has ignored the tragedy, at least initially, until they received signals from the Kremlin to it was okay to broadcast this story. And so, as you noted, in Kemerovo today, we saw anger just boiling over.
I mean, it sounded like it was really awful for the people trapped in this mall with exits either locked or non-existent. What happened in this fire, as you understand it?
Well, officially, you know, authorities say they don't know yet the cause of the fire. Not yet. What we do know is that the alert systems didn't work. Emergency doors were barred shut. Fire extinguishers didn't work. There was no organized evacuation. But, you know, there's a sense here that corruption primarily is at play, that safety inspectors were simply paid off to look the other way, that people just paid bribes to get the right paperwork so that they could get, meet the requirements while, in fact, not meeting the requirements. And certainly that seems to be the conclusion of Russian President Vladimir Putin. So he came to Kemerovo today. Let's hear what he has to say.
Что же у нас происходит? Это ведь не боевые действия, не выброс метана где-то в шахте.
So this is what Russians saw primarily on state television today, which is Putin berating local officials saying, what happened here? You know, this is not a war. It's not some unexpected, you know, explosion in a mine. These are people, children mainly, who just come to a mall for entertainment and, you know, say, why have we lost so many? Because of criminal negligence and mismanagement.
That's kind of an extraordinary response from the leader of the country to come in and not really feel sympathy, but to start blaming people.
Well, he did express condolences, it must be said. He made a trip over to a makeshift memorial that's emerged in Kemerovo. But that said, it was blocked off when Putin made his arrival there. Certainly, the reigning governor of the region also refused to meet with people. It is, I think, in some ways very typical of the response that's been to other tragedies here as well.
The people of Kemerovo are distraught and understandably angry, but it is a city that's almost 2,000 miles from Moscow. How is the rest of Russia processing this?
Well, I can speak for Moscow in particular. It's been a very subdued day here, very sad. You know, the sense just walking the streets today is that people are holding their children a little bit closer. There were memorials all across the country today in different cities.
I mean, you've got some people saying Putin should step down because of this. Not likely to happen, I imagine. But what kind of political spin are you starting to see around this fire and the blame that is being laid on the government?
Well, it must be said, you know, the government was really slow to react, but amid growing public anger, they've certainly shifted gears. And I think they've really tried to own, you know, this tragedy in a way, you know, own the sadness over this tragedy. Tomorrow is the official day of mourning. Even this Moscow memorial I attended tonight, that was the unofficial memorial. When authorities saw that thousands were planning to come to this event, they organized another one, which some say is a spoiler event to deflect public anger. And, you know, they've also cast aspersions on critics of the government, the opposition in particular, saying that they're out to politicize this event for their own gain.
Charles, there's also the way this fire is being used by critics of the countries like the U.S. that have been expelling Russian diplomats, as in, how could they expel Russians at a tragic time like this? How are these two stories playing together right now?
Well, you know, Marco, even yesterday there was a sense among people just in discussions online and certainly by many people who are no fans of the Russian government that the timing of the U.S. expulsions was just kind of improper, just kind of ugly. And today we saw the foreign ministry embrace that line of thinking, calling it an inhumane act that was sort of just you know, poor politics, an ugly act by the United States. Notable to say that Ambassador Huntsman, John Huntsman, the U.S. ambassador here in Moscow, you know, he released a statement saying that this coordinated expulsion was just too long in the works, that that's why the U.S. went ahead with it despite the tragedy.
Reporter Charles Maines there in Moscow. Let's hear now from a former deputy fire chief in Moscow. His name is Gleb Klivikin. He currently lives in Barcelona and, I should add, is free to talk about what happened in Kemerovo without recrimination. I asked him if he was surprised this had happened.
I was surprised as a person and not surprised as a professional because the problems were spoken out very long ago. They are systemic. And people within the service, especially those who work on the ground, they are aware of these problems. They are talking about them. They are trying to push them to change, but it doesn't move anywhere.
Well, investigators say that the fire alarm in the shopping center was turned off and that many exits were blocked. So those kind of circumstances, that doesn't surprise you.
Well, I would say from the experience, it's a common thing in Russia. The regulation is not followed entirely, and it's really hard to catch that. And it has much to do also with training of personnel. When you have an accident like that, you have to look for the mistake some steps behind, and the first is training. Now, due to lack of funding, we do not do the drills that we are supposed to work on before something happens.
So, Gleb, tell me about your own experience when you were a firefighter in Moscow. Did you ever have to respond to a fire in a building that just didn't have fire safety measures in place? And what was that like?
Of course, residential apartment building with only one exit. It was a 12-flight building with 8 flats at each level. And it's only one stairs. So it's one entrance, one stairs. And the issue with the building was the absence of water supply inside the building. And then you get the calls that there are people trapped. Then it just becomes too hard to tackle that. And as a firefighter on the ground, you will have to firefight whatever happens.
How frustrated are you by this whole situation? And what do you want to see happen?
Well, I'm extremely frustrated. To be honest, yesterday, I really hardly was finding the words to speak about that wouldn't contain some swear words. I'm very angry in general. I can say that I blame this system created by people who are not professionals, who have never seen fire in their life or never received any managing education.
Gleb Klivikin is a former deputy fire chief from Moscow, currently living in Barcelona. Really appreciate your time and shedding some light on this for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
The response of emergency services to a disaster, it's news in Britain today as well. You'll remember that last year, 22 people were killed and more than 700 injured by a suicide bomb attack at an Ariana Grande concert in Manchester, England. At the time, there were concerns about the speed with which emergency services responded to the attack. Today, those concerns were confirmed. An official report criticized fire services for taking 2 hours to get to the scene, even though they were not even that far away from the venue. The World's Leo Hornack in London has been looking into this. 2 hours for a bomb attack. I mean, an excruciatingly long time, it seems. What went wrong in the aftermath of the Manchester attacks, Leo?
Well, what we found out today is an awful lot went wrong. One of the things that comes out really clearly in the report is that, in fact, it was one of the plans to deal with a terror attack actually made things worse. That is, one of the official plans that was put in place for a similar situation to this actually resulted in a more difficult situation for all the survivors. And in particular, this was something called Operation Plato, which police switched to. And Operation Plato is based on the idea of a marauding attack. That is, a terrorist on the loose at the scene, armed and possibly continuing to attack people. And once the police had declared that Operation Plato was in place, that meant that fire services had to follow the rules, which meant they couldn't approach the blast scene. And one of the police officers is actually praised for disobeying procedures, disobeying that rule, and allowing paramedics to continue working and helping survivors. And one of the reasons that some paramedics and ambulances were there was they weren't aware that Operation Plato had been declared. So a really chaotic scene happening at that time on that horrible night.
Wow, multiple errors. So what was the impact on survivors because of this slow response?
The report itself refrains from making a judgment on that, but many of the people who lived through that evening have no doubt at all. This is a clip from a BBC interview with one of the survivors. His name's Rob Grew, and he was just one of the ordinary members of the public who began administering first aid as the emergency services were waiting outside. Here's what he told one of my BBC colleagues.
Apart from the three paramedics that were doing like a great job, that's as far as it went until we realised that no more support was coming from the medical teams or the ambulances.
Do you think that more people could have been saved if that help had been there?
Definitely in the first 15 minutes. Definitely more could have been done.
Incredible. Leo, there was a second failure highlighted in the report, and it relates to a phone service in the UK that I guess is best described as a national 911 system. What happened there?
Britain has a national mutual aid telephony system. Emergency call handlers, that's like 911 dispatchers, from across the country can be automatically patched into a local area in a disaster like this. So that means when there are hundreds or thousands of people calling up to find out about their relatives, there's many, many more people able to pick up the phones and respond. Now, this system just simply didn't work. And that meant that many families of people who died or been injured or were missing after the attack were having to visit hospitals to try and find out where their loved ones were. And you can only imagine the amount of unnecessary distress this caused.
So, Leo, what's going to happen now? Does it sound like these mistakes will be avoided and the system fixed before the next attack?
Well, a country like Britain is struggling right now and will be struggling to deal with very new kinds of attack. A thing like a suicide bomber needs a very different response from these marauding attacks. And we know, unfortunately, that our cities have encountered these kind of attacks in different combinations at different times. And so it's incredibly difficult for emergency services to have all the answers to the particular combination of violence that they might experience when a terrorist attack happens.
The World's Leo Hornack in London with the latest on what went wrong in the emergency response to last year's Ariana Grande concert in Manchester. Leo, thank you.
Thanks very much, Marco.
Just ahead on the show, a kid in the Central African Republic dreams of making it big in business. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. You know, I always keep this bottle of water here in the studio with me just to take a sip whenever I get a little thirsty. I can fill it up in the sink. I can fill it up in a water bubbler outside the studio. But for many people around the globe, getting water is still a huge challenge. I'm thinking specifically Cape Town, South Africa, which was supposed to run dry next month, but mercifully is not. The World's Livable Planet editor, Peter Thompson's here to talk about water shortages. Hey, Peter.
Hey, Marco.
So are people coming to some solutions on this problem?
Well, Cape Town's had a really severe drought. Their climate climate is shifting. It's becoming drier. They've really had to clamp down on water usage, and it seems to be working. We have three stories coming up from reporter Daniela Cheslow, and here's a little slice from one of them.
Cape Town officials have been warning for months now of an impending day zero, when the city's taps would be empty. They've threatened steep fines for residents who don't cut their water use to 13 gallons a day. And the extreme measures are working. Total water consumption is down to just over half of last year's amount.
Yeah, I know a lot of relief down there in Cape Town that they're able to keep the taps on now.
Although, you know, who knows what the weather is going to bring to Cape Town. But we've also got a story about a place where tap water is actually a new thing. It's from an exceptionally dry part of Morocco, and it's a pretty simple technological solution, harvesting water from clouds.
The fog comes in from the sea, Yabar says. The wind pushes it towards the nets, and droplets condense out and fall into a basin.
And then the water goes from the basin into these pipes, and these pipes go into the ground, then they go to a reservoir that I'm looking at right now, where it becomes filtered. Then it goes down again through more pipes and into the villages in the surrounding area.
Wow, harvesting water from clouds, pretty cool stuff.
And you know, that may even come in handy here in the U.S. We're going back into drought in California, and there's talk about putting this very system to work in California to harvest fog water there.
Our series on water shortages begins tomorrow. The world's Peter Thompson from our Livable Planet desk. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
It's not headline news here, but there's a crisis in the Central African Republic, and it's getting worse. The country first tumbled into chaos after a coup in 2013. Since then, militia groups, in their quest for power and resources, have targeted civilians. Fortuné Kibinda is one of an entire generation of children growing up in the middle of this war. We first met Fortuné in 2016. Back then, he had started a small food stall selling spaghetti and coffee. Reporter Brenna Daldorf returned to visit him.
In the Miskin neighborhood of Bangui, the lopsided houses are too close together for cars to pass. On a Saturday morning, women call out greetings from doorways. Kids chase each other, making tiny chicks scuttle after their mother hen. 16-year-old Fortuné seems oblivious to the noise. He's crouched over an open fire in front of his house, making a full meal of fish, rice, and fried yams. And he's sweating. He's got to finish by 1 p.m. in time for his friend Abigail's birthday party. I'm making something to surprise her, he says, grinning. Abigail is a member of the singing group that Fortuné started. Aside from school, for the lucky, most kids in the CAR don't have organized activities. Fortuné and his group hold rehearsals themselves, meeting after school during the week and after church on Sundays. A few hours later, the eight members of Fortuné's singing group stand in a circle in Abigail's living room. The rice and fish that Fortuné made are sitting on a big wooden table. The group's name is Efficace Divine, which means divine efficiency in French. Faith is really important to these kids.
À l'église, souvent on est ensemble. J'ai entendu comment ils ont chanté.
We go to church together, says Fortuné. I heard how they sing, and that's why I invited them to be my singers. The youngest member is just 10, while Fortuné and Abigail are the oldest, at age 16. A worn notebook contains their entire repertoire of hymns, which Fortuné wrote out by hand. The name Efficace Divine once belonged to another one of Fortuné's projects. Just over a year ago, he opened a kiosk where he sold coffee and spaghetti. As his business grew, he dreamed of someday owning a chain of restaurants, of being a successful businessman. Then, one day, he went to open his kiosk and found the entire wooden structure gone.
J'ai demandé, et m'ont dit que ça s'est passé la nuit.
I asked around and people told me it had been stolen that night, he says.
Je pense rien. J'ai pleuré et je suis retourné à la maison.
My mind was empty, he says. I just started crying and then I went home.
Parce que c'est tout ce que j'ai pour m'aider à avancer, c'est pour ça que j'ai pleuré.
It was all I had to help me get ahead, he says. That's why I cried. Fortuné lives with his great aunt, a house cleaner, and she didn't have the money to help him rebuild the kiosk. So Fortuné threw himself into something that didn't require an upfront investment, singing.
Ce qui a changé dans ma vie, c'est que je suis avancé dans la musique.
What changed in my life is that I'm getting ahead in music, he says.
C'est mon photo.
A photo on display in the family's living room shows Fortuné in a recording studio wearing big headphones.
Attends, c'est pas toi, non?
C'est moi.
C'est toi?
Oui, c'est moi, Fortuné.
The picture was taken when Fortuné recorded a song, which now plays on a local Christian radio station. The experience made him even more excited about his group.
Nous avons une idée de faire notre CD, de faire sortir notre album.
We want to make a CD, release an album, and send it to countries across Africa, he says. But all of that would require money.
Et si j'ai de l'argent, je pourrais recommencer encore ma cafétéria.
If I had some money again, he says, I could restart my kiosk and then invest in my singing group. But money is hard to come by in this precarious country where most people are just scraping by. So, Fortuné thinks the most likely way he'd get some money would be through divine intervention. He prays a lot. It keeps the uncertainty of the present and the sadness of the past from swallowing him up. Things like the loss of his mother, who died in a refugee camp.
Non, non, je ne pense pas à lui. Je pense qu'à Dieu.
No, I don't think about her, he says. I only think about God. He also says he doesn't even have time to think about girls. Not even Abigail?
Non, non, non. No.
Really?
Non, non, non. Pas ça. J'ai beaucoup de choses à faire dans ma vie. Et je
I have a lot to do in my life.
Ça va venir dans l'avenir.
There'll be time for that in the future, he says, and grins. But that future he talks about. The truth is, the crisis in the Central African Republic is getting worse. Bangui, where Fortuné lives, has some law and order, but most of the rest of the country is controlled by militia groups. There's widespread hunger and hundreds of thousands of people displaced. His country may be crumbling around him, but Fortuné is so sure he'll come out okay that his faith will carry him through.
Oh mon Dieu! Mon père, mon rocher, mon bouclier, je vends si fort.
There's this line in the song that he has playing on the radio. In it, he's speaking directly to God. I know that with you, I'll triumph, he sings. I'll reach the destiny that's burning in me. It's an amazing destiny, if only he can reach it.
J'atteindrai la destinée qui brûle en moi. Je sais que par toi, je triompherai.
For the world, this is Brenna Daldorf, Bangui, Central African Republic.
Oui, par toi, j'aurai la victoire.
Brenna produced her stories about Fortuné with the support of the International Women's Media Foundation. I'm Marco Werman. Still ahead on The World, how a young Mexican-American medic wound up in a Nazi concentration camp during World War II.
They took us to the gas chambers, and we saw the tubings, the pipes. One was for gas, the other one was for water.
Now the diary of Tony Acevedo is at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. His story, still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Elizabeth Mateo is an attorney in California. She also happens to be undocumented, both of which factor heavily into her vocal efforts to fight for immigrant rights. Earlier this month, Mateo made news when she was named advisor to a California State Senate committee that helps low-income students get into college. The World's Global Nation editor, Monica Campbell, has been following Mateo's story. So who is she? Who is Elizabeth Mateo, Monica? Where is she from?
She's from Oaxaca in southern Mexico, and her father was a cab driver there, and her mom took care of the kids and ran a small store. And when she was 14 in 1998, the family decided to move to California. They wanted a better education for her. And it was quite a switch for Mateo. She went from going to this small school in rural Mexico to a massive high school in Los Angeles. And she told me a little bit about that change.
It was very difficult at first. I remember I cried a lot when I started high school with almost 3,000 students. You know, most of them spoke English. And I felt very intimidated at times. I felt like I didn't fit in.
And Mateo really excelled, though. She went to a community college and then a state college. And there in university, she was among this group of undocumented students. And they were among the first to really start to organize and push for what we know as the DREAM Act today.
So, Monica, I've been reading that Mateo was a member of the Dream Nine. That's a group of young immigration reform activists who crossed the border into Mexico and then crossed back into the U.S., where they intentionally had themselves arrested and taken to U.S. custody. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was a really bold move. That was in 2013, and that's when I really started to notice the actions by young undocumented people. It's when I first started to follow Lisbeth Mateo and her story. And yeah, she went back to Mexico, even though she was undocumented in the United States. Their act of defiance was to go back to the home country and then go to the border and ask for asylum. And that's what she did. And she was detained at a detention center in California. And then she was let go and she was allowed to fight her case outside of this detention center. But what's really wild is that, you know, within a few days of being released from detention, she started law school at Santa Clara University here in Northern California. So, you know, she goes from being in a detention center to going to law school. And I asked her about that wild change in her life.
I was released. I went home. I hugged my parents, packed my bags, and then got on a plane. And my first day was very interesting. Everyone knew I was the girl who got detained at the border and 17 days in detention. People approached me and essentially asked, oh, so you're that girl. Not in a mean way. They were just very curious about who I was.
And so she graduated and she passed the bar exam. Mm-hmm. And now she's part of this handful of undocumented lawyers in the United States in some of the states in the country that allow people, you know, who do not have legal permanent residence to become lawyers. That's in California and in New York. And the idea, the argument here in California, at least, is that if you meet the requirements, if you show good moral character, pass the bar and get your license and do what you want to do. Of course, that's a very controversial thing in other parts of the country.
Sure. Just as an aside, Monica, what do you think would have happened if she had done that today?
You know, I asked her about that, and she said that she probably would not do that today under the Trump administration because it is much tougher to try and fight for asylum under, you know, stricter rules, but also that she might not even be allowed to ask for asylum. What we're hearing about people getting turned away when they ask for that. So it would be incredibly risky for her to do that today. And what Lisbeth Mateo and other undocumented activists are saying is that people need to tell their stories. They need to be visible. They need to not be afraid. And that is a mantra that has been part of, you know, the activist movement, the immigrant rights activist movement for years. And Mateo has been leading that. You know, when I was talking to her, it's really incredible that, you know, she's in her early 30s and she's one of the more veteran undocumented activists in the country. And I just think about her going to her law practice every day and this sort of bold move of defiance. At the same time, under the Trump administration, we are seeing people like her being targeted. And so I will continue to watch and follow her story because it is a test case about how strong the Trump administration may crack down on people like her.
Monica Campbell heads up the world's Global Nation desk. Monica, thanks very much for introducing us to Lisbeth Mateo.
You're welcome, Marco.
We're going to take a few minutes now to remember an extraordinary American, Anthony Acevedo, who died last month at the age of 93. Tony, as he was known, was a Mexican-American who served in World War II. But that's only part of the story. Tony was also a survivor of the Holocaust. The world's Chris Wolf has this profile.
Love. Kill them with kindness. If they treat you wrong, kill them with kindness. That was how Tony Acevedo dealt with cruelty, hardship, and violence. According to his son, Fernando, it was something Tony learnt young, growing up with an abusive father. Tony's response was always patience and compassion.
What I remember about my dad is Dad had this penetrating smile that, you know, you wanted to get to know him. You know, I mean, I know it sounds magical and far-fetched, but that's how he always was. And it used to irritate me because I was like a snot-nosed kid that was wondering why I couldn't get my way about something or why, you know, things didn't happen the way I wanted them to. But my dad would always say, you know, just have patience, you know.
But sometimes Fernando saw something else in his father.
He would just walk away, go to the porch or some parts of the house where he would be able to be by himself. And he would just start crying.
Anthony Acevedo was the first Mexican-American Catholic Holocaust survivor who registered with the museum as a survivor.
That's Kira Schuster, one of the curators of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum.
He was one of 350 American GIs who were captured during the Battle of the Bulge and then selected as slave laborers at Berga, which was a subcamp of the Buchenwald concentration camp.
He was deemed an undesirable by his Nazi captors.
It was hell.
Tony Acevedo was interviewed in 2013 by the Holocaust Museum.
It was just a thought after another thought of praying that there wouldn't be another day like this.
Tony was born in San Bernardino, California in 1924 to undocumented parents. And in 1937, his family was deported to Mexico.
They were forced out of the United States because they were Mexican citizens and not American citizens. And they had no, I understood that they had no documents.
Tony, however, was a U.S. citizen and was drafted into the army after Pearl Harbor. He went willingly, partly to escape his father. When the army found out he wanted to be a doctor, they trained him as a medic. His unit arrived in France in December 1944 and was immediately rushed to the front to try to turn back the final German offensive of the war, what became known as the Battle of the Bulge. After 10 days in combat, his company was surrounded and forced to surrender. Tony was sent to a POW camp, but the Gestapo secret police pulled him in for special interrogation. They thought he was a spy.
And I kept denying, and every time I denied, he slapped my face. Then he started to put needles in my fingernails.
After a month in the POW camp, this happened.
We were forced to come out of the barracks and lined up. And then the commander said, all American Jews, take two steps forward.
A selection was being made. An order had arrived for 350 slave laborers. They started with the Jewish GIs, but there weren't enough.
Then the commander came by, and then he poked at me, put me up front. It's an undesirable.
What followed is a familiar story to those who've studied the Holocaust, but few know this happened to American POWs.
Put us on a train, a boxcar, where you couldn't kneel, you couldn't squat for 6 days.
No food, no water, just snow. For 6 days, until they reached the concentration camp at Berga.
When we got to Berga, well, they took us to the cremation center to bathe us. Well, we didn't know that was for a bathing. We thought they were going to cremate us. They took us to the gas chambers. They took us there, and we saw that the tubings, the pipes up ahead, one was for gas, the other one was for water.
The GIs got showers, but then began a brutal life of slave labor, digging tunnels on starvation rations. Within a week, the GIs started dying. Any caught trying to escape were executed. Tony started to keep a diary and hid it in his pants. It included a list of those who perished. Kira Schuster of the Holocaust Museum.
His list was really one of the primary resources for our knowledge and the Army's knowledge of what the fate was for many of these men. And when I asked Tony, you know, why did you keep the diary? Why did you keep the list? Because certainly if he had been caught, he would have been, you know, severely punished or beaten or possibly even killed for it. And he just looked at me and said it was my moral obligation to do so.
Tony also drew sketches of life and death in the concentration camp at Berga. In early April 1945, with the Allies closing in and snow still on the ground, the Germans ordered the emaciated prisoners out of the camp. They were marched for more than 200 miles.
Oh, we were just almost at the tail end of where we just, our men were dropping off the highway out of the lines of the march. Up ahead, we noticed that the Germans were slaughtering political prisoners. We call them political prisoners, but it turned out to be they were Jewish fellas and families, children, mothers, and older fellas.
After more than 2 weeks on the march, suddenly, most of the guards fled. U.S. tanks soon appeared. Here's Tony reading from his diary in a CNN interview.
We were liberated today, April the 23rd, 1945.
Tony was 5'10", but he was down to just 87 pounds. He was lucky to survive. Less than half of the 350 U.S. POWs sent to Berger returned home. Tony did not become a doctor. His artistic skill led him into a successful career in aerospace design. He had his troubles, yet his son Fernando recalls how he was almost always smiling.
He was this dancing person. He loved to dance. And whether it was the cumbia, you know, from Cuba, or any kind of Latin music, he would just get into this dancing. And he used to do that around the house with my mother, you know, that he was married to for 40 years. He was jovial. He was happy. He was laughing. He liked to play jokes. He never walked around with a frown.
Tony proudly flew the American flag and the POW flag on his lawn. He was a conservative Republican. But according to Fernando, he had recently become concerned that politicians were pitting people against each other.
He had a hard time with what he saw going on. Especially this last year, we would watch, you know, the news and switch it from different news stations. He just did not like what he saw.
In later life, Tony was a frequent guest speaker in schools and colleges across Southern California. He wanted to raise awareness to help prevent anything like the horror he experienced from happening again.
It could happen.
He told the students he met, there's only one way to fight hate.
They must learn to able to love more, to understand, and be able to get along with each other and respect each other and respect others.
Kill them with kindness. If they treat you wrong, kill them with kindness.
Tony Acevedo, World War II veteran, Holocaust survivor, died last month. He was 93. For the world, I'm Chris Wolf.
We've got some archival video of Tony Acevedo on our Facebook page. Just head over to Facebook and search for the world. Here's one from News of the Weird. You know the saying, smoke 'em if you got 'em? Well, it seems an Asian elephant in India took that message to heart. The beast was caught on camera, puffing away. My BBC colleague Victoria Gill's been checking out the video.
The video looks remarkable. It's a video of a female elephant in the forest. It's sort of a little bit hidden by some trees, but you can clearly see her head. And she appears to be taking something up from the forest floor with her trunk. And then as she kind of ingests it, she then puffs out what looks like huge billows of smoke. It's not clear that anything is actually on fire in that image. What she's puffing out is ashes from either a controlled burn or a natural fire on the forest floor, but it really looks like she is smoking and exhaling these huge clouds of ash.
Yeah, so what's going on? Victoria Gill says scientists are kind of baffled, but they have some theories.
The key theory seems to be, is it a little bit disappointing for people who are sort of sharing the video suggesting that this is a smoking elephant, but it appears to be that what she's actually doing is treating herself with natural charcoal. So it's interesting because the forest floor in these areas, especially in national parks, they will carry out controlled burns of those areas. And also there'll be natural fires that will sort of turn over that kind of forest undergrowth and enhance nutrients. And when that burn obviously leaves a lot of ash, it leaves a lot of charcoal in its wake. Now, charcoal is really interesting because it's very, very porous and it absorbs toxins. So the elephant might be self-medicating as it's kind of digging up and rooting around for the charcoal with its trunk. It's then taking it into its mouth. But then what it looks like it's breathing out is it's kind of puffing out all of the sort of waste ash. So it looks a lot like smoke because that's what smoke kind of looks like, little tiny particles of ash. So not smoking, but definitely smoky.
BBC science reporter Victoria Gill. Finally today, Me Too has just been complimented by Chega. That's enough in Portuguese. A group of women sports journalists in Brazil have launched a campaign to demand an end to sexual harassment. The campaign launched on Sunday during a soccer game at Rio's massive Maracanã Stadium. A video played on the Jumbotrons. It showed actual footage of women reporters being grabbed by athletes, followed by dozens of women sports journalists proclaiming they're not going to take it anymore.
Chega. Deixa ela trabalhar.
Chega, they say. That's enough. And then deixa ela trabalhar, or let her work. That's the hashtag for their campaign on social media. Ida Sandes is a journalist with Sport TV and one of the women in the video. She spoke with us from Rio earlier today. And a quick warning here, there's some strong language describing an incident of harassment. Ida, these campaigns often start, sadly, with disturbing revelations. How did this campaign start?
So, Marco, it started with a small group of journalists, 10 journalists, in the same week of the Women's International Day. And they are discussing about some ideas. And the same week, it happened two situations with two reporters in Rio and Porto Alegre. And, you know, it was enough. And we called other colleagues and we made a group in WhatsApp. Now we are 60 journalists, reporters, editors, presenters, social media, whatever.
Mm. And what happened to that reporter that you were talking about?
She was live and a guy kissed her. In the video, you can see in the beginning of that. And another case, another supporter. It's not a supporter, I mean, but it's called supporter. Called her puta. It's like a bitch. Because she was interviewing him and because of, you know, the confusion and passion of his team. But it's not, we don't want to allow this anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it's enough. Chega. Because it happens all the time in the stadiums. You know,
well, you're now an editor at Sport TV. But until recently, you were regularly reporting at stadiums, interviewing players in the middle of fans.
Yes.
How pervasive is the harassment and what forms does it take? I mean, have you been a victim?
Yeah. I think every woman that works with that in Brazil, even all around the world, but especially in Brazil, because we have a machist culture here.
Macho,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I heard a lot of things during my career. My opinions is not enough because I'm a woman. You have to prove more, so much more, because just you are a woman, you know?
Why do you think this campaign is happening now, Ida? I mean, is there any coincidence with what's happening with Me Too all over the globe?
Yeah, because the world now are open with this idea, the discussion about the women possibilities and the space of the women in every positions of work. The power of this movement is the union. You know,
well, there's a spot in your video where one woman says, together we are stronger, and another says, together we are invincible. Are women sports journalists truly united in this fight?
Yeah. This is the first time that all the sports journalists are together with this. Lots of people from all the TV channels and newspaper and radio and web.
And what about men? What about the men sports journalists? Are they backing you?
Yes, they are, you know, but I personally, I think that they could support more. But yes, they are supporting. We had a great visibility and coverage of this movement in the TV shows here. It started so small and it's getting bigger. So we are planning now the next steps of this movement. It's not only the video. It's a real movement to change and to claim for respect, mainly.
Yeah, what do you see coming out of this campaign? A behavior change or some kind of policy change?
Sure, both. Behavior change, I think this is the most important thing. And also policy. And we are talking about some public and juristic institutions to support us. And
yeah, I read that the day the campaign launched, there was this incident at a stadium in the south of Brazil, in Porto Alegre, in which a man was arrested for allegedly harassing a female sports reporter. Is this what you want? Do you want people to be arrested when this happens?
Exactly. It happens all the time. The difference now is that Kelly, is the reporter, she decided to talk, and people of the stadium decided to do something. And the same day that we launched the video, so the things are really changing.
Ida Sandes is a journalist with Sport TV and one of the women in Brazil pushing for an end to harassment of women sports reporters. Ida, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And that'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.